We'd like to welcome everyone with the beginning of our cold weather, but it's nice and warm in here. And Brother Ted has chosen a very interesting topic for our consideration. The title of Ted's remark will be Written for Our Instruction. Written for Our Instruction. Brother Ted.
Thank you, Brother Irwin. The Apostle Paul is the one who instructed us to consider the words of the Old Testament for lessons of conduct, to receive comfort, and to provide a basis for our hope. He said these things would be especially appropriate for those living at this time. 1 Corinthians 10:11. Now all these things happened unto them for ensamples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. He added to that thought in Romans, the 15th chapter, verse 4, when he said, For whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope. Some of the accounts of the Old Testament are written to establish and strengthen our faith in God and His Word. And some accounts are for the purpose of giving us an understanding of things that were promised and have been fulfilled or are yet to come. And others are for the purpose of giving us instruction in righteous living. In our consideration of God's dealings with the Israelites, we find principles of God's character revealed to us that we might conduct ourselves in a way that would be pleasing to Him. Some of the instructions of God, from God to His people are very specific and direct, and some, in contrast, are very subtle and must be considered carefully to find the reason for their being given to us and the principles behind them in order to get the lesson that we might apply to our own lives and to find what God was trying to teach us. Our lesson for today, we believe, is of the latter variety. It is the lesson recorded in the book of Joshua, the 22nd chapter. And for quite some time, it has intrigued me and has been on my list of topics for future discourses. There's been one deterrent to using this subject for a discourse, and that is this. As far as I could find, there is not one word of comment on this chapter in the Harvest Message. Nonetheless, we will attempt a consideration of the subject today, trusting that we might take the principles of the Lord's Word that we have learned and gain some additional insight into God's direction for our hearts. I have enlisted the assistance of several brethren who will read chapter 22 of the book of Joshua from the New International Version, a copy of which has been on your handout. Brother Dan Trina will begin.
Then Joshua summoned the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and said to them, "Ye have done all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded, and you have obeyed me in everything I commanded. For a long time now, to this very day, you have not deserted your brothers, but have carried out the mission the Lord your God gave you. Now that the Lord your God has given your brothers rest as he has promised, return to your homes in the land that Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you on the other side of the Jordan. But be very careful to keep the commandment and the law that Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to obey his commandments, to hold fast to him, and to serve him with all your heart and all your soul." Then Joshua blessed them and sent them away, and they went to their homes.
To half the tribe of Manasseh, Moses had given land in Bashan, and to the other half of the tribe, Joshua gave land on the west side of the Jordan with their brothers. When Joshua sent them home, he blessed them, saying, Return to your homes with your great wealth, with large herds of livestock, with silver, gold, bronze, and iron, and a great quantity of clothing, and divide with your brothers the plunder from your enemies. So the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh left the Israelites at Shiloh in Canaan to return to Gilead, their own land which they had acquired in accordance with the command of the Lord through Moses. When they came to Gelilah near the Jordan in the land of Canaan, the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an imposing altar there by the Jordan. And when the Israelites heard that they had built the altar on the border of Canaan at Gelilah near the Jordan on the Israelite side, the whole assembly of Israel gathered at Shiloh to go to war against them.
So the Israelites sent Phinehas, son of Eleazar the priest, to the land of Gilead, to Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. With him they sent 10 of the chief men, one for each of the tribes of Israel, each the head of a family division amongst the Israelite clans. When they went to Gilead, to Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh, they said to them, "The whole assembly of the Lord says, how could you break faith with the God of Israel like this? How could you turn away from the Lord and build yourselves an altar in rebellion against him now? Was not the sin of Peor enough for us? Up to this very day we have not cleansed ourselves from that sin, even though a plague fell on the community of the Lord. And are you now turning away from the Lord? If you rebel against the Lord today, tomorrow he will be angry with the whole community of Israel. If the land you possess is defiled, come over to the Lord's land, where the Lord's tabernacle stands, and share the land with us. But do not rebel against the Lord or against us by building an altar for yourselves other than the altar of the Lord our God." When Achan, son of Zerah, acted unfaithfully regarding the devoted things, did not wrath come upon the whole community of Israel? He was not the only one who died for his sin.
Then Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh replied to the heads of the clans of Israel, "The mighty one, God, the Lord, the mighty one, God, the Lord. He knows, and let Israel know. If this has been in rebellion or disobedience to the Lord, do not spare us this day. If we have built our own altar to turn away from the Lord and to offer burnt offerings and grain offerings, or to sacrifice fellowship offerings on it, may the Lord himself call us to account. No, we did for fear that someday your descendants might say to ours, 'What do you have to do with the Lord, the God of Israel?' The Lord has made the Jordan a boundary between us and you, you Reubenites and Gadites. You have no share in the Lord, so your descendants might cause ours to stop fearing the Lord. That is why we said, 'Let us get ready and build an altar,' but not for burnt offerings or sacrifices. On the contrary, it is to be a witness between us and you and the generations that follow, that we will worship the Lord at his sanctuary with our burnt offerings, sacrifices, and fellowship offerings. Then in the future, your descendants will not be able to say to ours, 'You have no share in the Lord.' And we said, if they ever say this to us or to our descendants, we will answer, 'Look at the replica of the Lord's altar, which our fathers built, not for burnt offering and sacrifices, but as a witness between us and you. Far be it from us to rebel against the Lord and turn away from him today by building an altar for burnt offerings, grain offerings, and sacrifices, other than the altar of the Lord, our God, that stands before his tabernacle."
When Phinehas the priest and the leaders of the community, the heads of the clans of the Israelites, heard what Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh had to say, they were pleased. And Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the priest, said to Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh, "Today we know that the Lord is with us because you have not acted unfaithfully toward the Lord in this matter. Now you have rescued the Israelites from the Lord's hand." Then Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the priest, and the leaders returned to Canaan from their meeting with the Reubenites and Gadites in Gilead and reported to the Israelites. They were glad to hear the report and praised God. And they talked no more about going to war against them to devastate the country where the Reubenites and the Gadites lived. And the Reubenites and the Gadites gave the altar this name, a witness between us that the Lord is God.
Thank you, brethren. Let's go back to the beginning of the chapter and consider in some detail the background for the events we just read about. This event took place probably about 6 years after the Israelites crossed the Jordan River into the Promised Land, defeated their enemies, and apportioned the land to the various tribes. When the Israelites reached the Jordan River, the tribes of Reuben and Gad petitioned Moses and Eleazar to receive the land on the west side of the Jordan as their inheritance. That's found in Numbers, the 32nd chapter. We will note in referring to the 2.5 tribes that sometimes only Reuben and Gad are mentioned in the text. But from Numbers, the 32nd chapter and the 33rd verse, we're assured that the half-tribe of Manasseh is included, even though sometimes they are left out of mention. At first, when they asked for this inheritance, it angered Moses, and he accused them of behavior reminiscent of their fathers, who had spied out the land and gave a false report, which reflected cowardice and a lack of trust in God. But they assured Moses that this was not their intent, to abandon their brethren in the fight for the land, but they would first build sheepfolds for their cattle and abodes for their families, and then the men would fight side by side with their brethren and would not return unto their families until all received the inherited lands. Having made good on their promise, Joshua calls the tribes of Reuben and Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh and declares that they have fulfilled their promise, and he sends them away with his blessing and the admonition to follow the law that had been given them by Moses. The men of the 2.5 tribes depart for their home, having received the gratitude of the remainder of the people, who are in a sense beholding to these who had helped them to secure the inheritance that they had coming, and assured them that they were guiltless before the Lord, as Moses said they would be. Though the scriptures do not say specifically, no doubt they had shared in the casualties of the war and were going home without some of those who had given their lives in battle. They returned to their homes with some of the spoils of their efforts and were instructed to share these with those that they had left behind. In verses 10 and 11, the New International Version says that they came to Gilgaloth, which was on the Israelite side of the Jordan, and that they built an imposing altar there. Most other translations interpret this word, Strong's number 1552, as referring to a region, territory, and not a specific place. And some give the thought that the area was not on the Israelite side of the Jordan, but opposite the sons of Israel, as Rotherham says, against the land of Canaan in the King James, and facing the land of Canaan in the New English Version. I like the reasoning of some commentators, which said it seemed quite evident that they did not build this altar on the west or Israelite side of the Jordan, for that was not their territory, where they would have no control over its safety, and where it could not have borne witness for them. Further, consider that there is no mention by the Israelites of simply going and destroying the altar, which would have been an easy solution to the problem if it had been built in their territory without their approval. And so we would conclude that as the 2.5 tribes were going home, they conceived the idea of building this altar, and when they crossed the Jordan into their own land, they implemented their idea and built this imposing altar, which could be seen by the Israelites from the other side. We wonder what it was that gave rise to the idea that these returning soldiers should erect an altar. Was there anything in the past that would have given them the thought that this was the appropriate thing to do? In the Old Testament, 402 times out of 406, the word altar appears. It is taken from Strong's 4196, and it is always translated altar. It is derived from the word which means to slaughter, for sacrifice. It is the word that is always used in regard to the brazen altar in the tabernacle, where the animals were sacrificed. But it is also the word that is used for the incense or golden altar, where, as far as we know, only incense was offered. It would seem that the word altar, therefore, has a broader meaning, and this would seem to be borne out by the fact that there are several instances preceding this one in Joshua 22 where an altar was erected as a monument to an event worthy of remembrance. We'll look at just a few. In Genesis 12, 7 and 8, we have the first of two instances, and they involve Abram. Genesis 12, 7 and 8. And the Lord appeared unto Abram and said, Unto thy seed will I give this land. And there builded he an altar unto the Lord, who appeared unto him. And he removed from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel, and he pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west, and Ahi on the east. And there he builded an altar unto the Lord, and called upon the name of the Lord. In the first of these events, Abram built an altar because it was the place where God had appeared unto him. And in the latter, he builds an altar because it was the place where he called upon the name of the Lord. There's no mention of sacrifice, but rather it appears that Abram wanted to commemorate what happened here and to mark the place so that it would be a reminder to him. In Genesis, the 26th chapter, is the story regarding the three wells that Isaac's servants dug. After digging the first well, the local herdsman claimed the right to the water, and so Isaac moved and had his servants dig another well. The result of this was the same as the first, and so Isaac moved on and had his servants dig a third well. This time, they had no confrontation with the local people. And he said in verse 22 of Genesis 26, For now the Lord hath made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land. And he went up from thence to Beersheba. And the Lord appeared unto him the same night and said, I am the God of Abraham, thy father. Fear not, for I am with thee, and will bless thee and multiply thy seed for my servant Abraham's sake. And he builded an altar there, and called upon the name of the Lord, and pitched his tent there, and there Isaac's servants digged a well. Here again we note that there is no mention of a sacrifice, but instead a marking of a place where he had contact with God. If these two instances were too far removed from those that were returning from battle to have been an incentive for them to build an altar, they had also witnessed two others. In Exodus, the 17th chapter, we have the account of the battle of the Amalekites against Israel, where Moses stood upon the hill and held up his hands. When he held his hands up, Israel prevailed. And when he put his hands down, Amalek prevailed. Finally, they had to get a stone for him to sit on. And Aaron and Hur held up his arms until the nation of Israel had been victorious. The actions of Moses are recorded in Exodus 17, 14 to 16. And the Lord said unto Moses, Write this for a memorial in a book, and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Jehovah Nissi. For he said, because the Lord hath sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. The Lord instructed Moses to write this for a memorial on a scroll and make sure that Joshua heard it. And then Moses built an altar to commemorate the event, and he called it Jehovah Nissi, the Lord is my banner. The last of the things that we will consider that might have been at the root of the idea of building an altar was what happened when the Israelites crossed the Jordan River into the Promised Land. The accounts found in the third and fourth chapters of Joshua. We'll read Joshua 4:4-7. Then Joshua called the 12 men whom he had prepared of the children of Israel, out of every tribe a man. And Joshua said unto them, pass over before the ark of the Lord your God into the midst of the Jordan, and take up every man of you a stone upon his shoulder, according unto the number of the tribes of the children of Israel, that this may be a sign among you, that when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, what mean ye by these stones? Then ye shall answer them, that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord, when it passed over the Jordan. The waters of the Jordan were cut off, and these stones shall be a memorial unto the children of Israel forever. So we see once again a monument being erected to commemorate an important occurrence in history of this nation. It's true that this was not called an altar, but it fits the instructions of how to build an altar that would be acceptable to God, as given in Exodus, the 20th chapter, from verses 24 to 26. There is enough precedent in Scripture to understand that the idea of the homeward bound 2.5 tribes was not something new that they had conjured up to separate them and make them appear great in the eyes of their brethren. They had spent the better part of 6 years away from their families and were now going to commemorate this experience with the altar that they were about to erect. When the other tribes heard about the altar, their reaction was to go to war and annihilate the ones that had turned away from God. What an extreme reaction. Why was it that the 9.5 tribes could not see this in the same light as the ones who had built the altar? Why were they so vindictive and out to show these brethren that they had turned into infidels and were deserving of destruction? Let's look at their side of the equation. The first commandment which Moses brought to all of Israel was something which they realized they were not to trifle. The commandment said, thou shalt have no other gods before me. The rumor that they had heard was that these rebels had built an altar, and the purpose of it was to use it in the worship of other gods. They recalled two incidents referred to in verse 17 and verse 20. Both of these incidents resulted in severe punishment by God. The iniquity of Peor is a reference to an incident that is recorded in Numbers 25. It deals with the enticement of the Israelites to worship the god of the Midianites, Baal Peor. The time is after Aaron had already died, when Moses was yet on the scene, and they had not yet crossed the Jordan. Numbers 25:1-9. When Israel was staying in Shittim, the men began to indulge in sexual immorality with Moabite women, who invited them to sacrifice to their gods. The people ate and bowed down before these gods. So Israel joined in worshiping the Baal of Peor, and God's anger burned against them. And God said to Moses, take all the leaders of these people, kill them, and expose them in broad daylight before the Lord, so that the Lord's fierce anger may turn away from Israel. So Moses said to Israel's judges, each of you must put to death those of your men who have joined in the worshiping of Baal of Peor. Then an Israelite man brought to his family a Midianite woman right before the eyes of Moses and the whole assembly of Israel while they were weeping at the entrance of the tent of meeting. When Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw this, he left the assembly and took a spear in his hand and followed the Israelite into the tent. He drove the spear through both of them, through the Israelite and into the woman's body. Then the plague against the Israelites was stopped. But those who died in the plague numbered 24,000. The Israelites were right to fear the punishment of the Lord, which they had experienced just a few years ago. They remembered how those that defected in the worship of Jehovah were all slain, and they wanted to prevent this from happening again. The second incident in verse 20 in regard to Achan is a reference to the events recorded in Joshua the 7th and 8th chapters, and it deals with Achan of the tribe of Judah. When Israel conquered the city of Jericho, they were instructed to burn the city, but to remove the articles of silver and gold and of bronze and place them in the treasury of the Lord. But one amongst the Israelites acted unfaithfully and took a robe that had come from Babylonia and silver and gold and kept them for himself, unbeknownst to any of his brethren. God did not single out this individual for punishment, but allowed that nation to go up in battle against the city of Ahi. Being a small city, they decided to only send 3,000 men to take the city. But they were routed by the inhabitants of the city, and it had the effect of disheartening the people. After Joshua prayed and waited on the Lord before the tabernacle, God spoke to him and revealed that one of the Israelites had sinned by taking some of the things that belonged to the Lord for himself, and that Israel would not have the Lord on their side until they had put to death the one who had committed this act. Joshua singled out the individual, who then admitted his guilt and revealed the hiding place for the loot. The people took Achan and his wife and his children and stoned them and burned their bodies and buried them under a pile of stones. The difference between the previous one and this instance was that not only the guilty individual was punished, but his family also. And not only his family, but the whole nation had suffered the loss of those who had been killed in battle. And so we see a second reason for their fear, that the Lord would hold them responsible for the evil that they saw and failed to correct. And yet there was another factor which influenced their attitude about what their brethren were up to. It's alluded to in several scriptures, and most distinctly stated in Deuteronomy, the 12th chapter. Deuteronomy 12, 10 to 14. But when you go over Jordan and dwell in the land which the Lord your God giveth you to inherit, and when he giveth you rest from all your enemies round about so that you dwell in safety, then there shall be a place which the Lord your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell there. Thither shall you bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, and the heave offerings of your hand, and all your choice vows which you vow unto the Lord. And ye shall rejoice before the Lord your God, ye and your sons and your daughters, and your men servants and your maid servants, and the Levite that is within your gates, for as much as he hath no part nor influence with you. Take heed unto thyself that thou offer not thy burnt offerings in every place that thou seest, but in the place which the Lord shall choose, in one of thy tribes, there shalt thou offer thy burnt offerings, and there shalt thou do all that I command thee. The place that God had chosen was in Shiloh, and that is where the tabernacle was erected and stood, being recognized by all of Israel as the only place for them to offer sacrifices. Coupled with this was the thought that God would punish the whole nation for the sins of a few, and made the majority of Israel want to put an end to what they saw as sins of their brethren. They realized that God would hold them responsible if they did nothing, and so the people were ready to go to war, and probably would have if clearer heads had not prevailed. Instead, they sent Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the high priest, as the head of the delegation, and with him the chief of each of the 10 tribes. When the delegation came to the tribes of Reuben and Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh, they began their dialogue not with a threat or a direct accusation, but they put it in the form of an inquiry. He states that they think there are sins that they have committed, and lets them know that they are concerned because God is dealing with them as a nation, and that the sins of one might bring a loss of God's favor to all. To show their sincerity for their brethren's welfare, in the midst of his remarks, Phinehas makes an amazing offer. He proposes to those living on the east side of the Jordan that if they feel that their land is polluted by the virtue of contact they have had with previous inhabitants and their false gods that they worshipped, then they should pack up their families and their belongings and bring them over to the other side of Jordan. This delegation must have known that this would mean redistributing all of the land of Israel in order to accommodate their brethren. And yet they did not hesitate to make the offer. We note that the representatives of the 2.5 tribes did not object or interrupt the words of Phinehas, but sat and listened to all he had to say. Then the spokesman for the 2.5 tribes arose to present their defense to their brethren. They recognized the seriousness of the accusations and the just consequences, and state that if they were true, they invited God to destroy them that very day, trusting that God could read their hearts and he knew their motives. They explained to their brethren their continued desire to worship and sacrifice their offerings at the tabernacle at Shiloh. Then they explained to their brethren what motivated them to build the altar. They were afraid that after years had passed and new generations had come on the scene, those of the 9.5 tribes would forget the efforts of those who had helped them drive the enemies out of their land and would say to the descendants of the 2.5 tribes, "You live on the other side of the Jordan. That's not part of Israel. Therefore, you are not part of God's chosen people." Do you think there was any basis for that fear? We think there was. You remember when all the people gathered at the Jordan River, the Lord stopped the waters of the Jordan when the priests bearing the ark put their feet into the water. This was considered the entering into the promised land. It made no difference that Joshua had confirmed the inheritance of the 2.5 tribes on the east side of the Jordan. The people still looked at the crossing of Jordan as marking the beginning of the fulfillment of receiving the promised land. Here it was that the representatives of the tribes erected the 12 stones, and it was after they crossed the Jordan that the rite of circumcision was once more renewed. So it was quite reasonable that the 2.5 tribes would feel that their brethren would in the future forget that they too lived in the promised land and were really a part of Israel. To reinforce their assurance to their brethren, they invite their brethren to look at the pattern the construction of the altar, and take note that it is not built to sacrifice as the brazen altar of the tabernacle, but as a witness, as a monument, a memorial to the fact that they too were Israelites. And when Phinehas and the other representatives heard these words, they believed them. They believed them and said that they perceived that God was amongst all of them. He also mentions that the 2.5 tribes have delivered the rest of Israel from God's hand. If they had gone to war without just cause, God would have punished them for their actions. There was no measure of doubt expressed on the part of Phinehas or the others of the delegation, like, we believe you now, but we're going to keep our eye on you. But on the contrary, they were pleased to report the truth of the matter to their brethren. And this altar became a witness between them of their belief and trust in God. Now, if this were just a fairy tale, it would conclude with, and they lived happily ever after. But it is not, and they did not. And we find no other reference to this incident anywhere else in Scripture. So let us for a few minutes consider what was commendable and what were the actions which fell short of that and what lessons we can learn and apply to our dealings with our brethren. First of all, when the news of the building of the altar came to the 9.5 tribes, we note that some of them interpreted what the meaning of the altar was. They evidently believed that there could only be an evil motive behind the actions, and therefore were ready to go to war on the assumption that they knew the motive of their brethren. In this they erred on both counts. To their credit, they did not follow the suggestion to go to war, but chose that which was much more in harmony with what Jesus would teach his followers some 1,600 years later in regard to how to handle an injury of one brother to another, found in Matthew 18. Although this did not involve only two individuals, we think it provides a pattern to follow when there is a situation which involves much more than just two brethren. They began by choosing a representative to head the delegation, whose position as a priest and one who was in line to become high priest marked him as one who had the respect of the people, one who had a reverence for God and an understanding of his word and its proper application. He had a good grasp of God's precepts as well as an appreciation of the weaknesses of all the people. In addition to him, they chose a representative from each of the tribes, a prince. That has the meaning of a father, grandfather, or progenitor. It's a term of honor and respect. Remember that there was a comparable group that Moses had chosen to assist him in the judging of matters of dispute amongst the people while they were in the wilderness. These 10 men were to listen and to report the matter to the tribes that had sent them. Surely, the makeup of this delegation had the effect of impressing upon the ones they came to see of the seriousness of the matter they came to discuss. When they began their statement of why they had come, most translators agree that they put their accusations in the form of questions to give room for a defense or explanation of their actions. The 2.5 tribes not only listened to all that their accusers had to say, but they did not take on the attitude of accusing their brethren of doing wrong by judging their actions, but humbly explained their motives. There was no attempt to put themselves above their brethren as one who had been unjustly maligned, but they gave a truthful explanation of what they had done and why they did it. The willingness of the 2.5 tribes to invite God's punishment that very day indicates a submission to in a harmony with God's principles. The receiving with joy of the report of the delegation by the 10 tribes that had sent them indicated a willingness to dismiss what had been a misunderstanding and to realize the mistake that they had made. And what might be the lesson that we would take for our own conduct? If we are in the role of the one of, that is here sought, spoken of as the accuser, we ought to carefully examine whether we are judging the motives of our brethren by what we see of their actions. We ought to consider if we are drawing wrong conclusions because we cannot read the heart. We should be willing to believe an honest and good report and thereafter help to vindicate those who have been misunderstood or wrongly accused. If we are the one that is accused, we would do well to listen to the accusations of others without interpreting to justify ourselves by condemning others. We should be willing to take advice and counsel from those whom the Lord has indicated are competent by virtue of their walk with Him. We should be willing to give an honest explanation of our actions, which have been a stumbling block to our brethren. And we should fully realize that submission to the chastening experiences that God allows us to have is necessary for our success in the narrow way. Have you thought of any additional lessons you might apply to yourself? If you have, then we have succeeded here today. If you have not, the rereading of Joshua 22 and meditation on its principles might be worthwhile.